This means that Donald Trump will be the 45th president of the United States.
This is your life now. This is our election now. This is us. This is our country. It's real.
Hi, and welcome back to the 45th. Rabia here, and I'm here, as always, with my colleague Susan Simpson. Hey, Susan, how are you?
Hey, Rabia. I am doing just fantastic. Loving every minute of our lives these days.
Yeah, we just never know how it's all going to go down, but things are not looking great. However, I am excited about this week's episode because we have a little bit of a distraction. We have a fantastic guest joining us this week who I've known for a few years now because of a short stint I had at a think tank that he's currently with. So I want to introduce our guest, Peter Singer, first to our listeners and then pick his brain over all the stuff he knows. So Peter Singer is currently a strategist at New America, formerly known New America Foundation. It's a DC think tank. He previously served at the Office of the Secretary of Defense. He's been an editor at Popular Science Magazine, and he's the founding director of the Center for the 21st Century Security and Intelligence at Brookings Institute. Pete has been named by the Smithsonian as one of the nation's 100 leading innovators, by Defense News as one of the 100 most influential people in defense issues, and by Foreign Policy to their top 100 global thinkers list. Amazing. And he's the author of multiple best-selling award-winning books. His seventh book, I believe it's his seventh, is just coming out. It's called Burn In, a novel of the real robotic revolution. And by the way, Susan, I got an advance copy of this. Oh my God, you would love it. It's amazing.
Robots?
Yes. A robotic revolution.
Go on.
Yes. So I want to welcome Peter to the show, and then we can talk a little bit about the book. Hi, Peter. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. It's really exciting to join you. I'm speaking to you not from the think tank, from the new home office of it that's doubling as a elementary school right now. So it's fantastic no. for me to also be talking to some different adults. Thanks for having me on.
Well, how old are the little ones?
They are both in elementary school. One's in fifth and one's in first grade. And you know, we're all surviving. We're doing well. The good thing, I guess, as you know, you had a very kind intro, is I'm a bit of, you know, the technical term is futurist. So you could see a lot of these trends coming, and I stockpiled Pop-Tarts and Cheetos and all their favorite junk foods, massive bags of M&Ms. So we're not eating healthily.
Peter, are you responsible for the toilet paper problems that we're having? Was that all you? You had a stockpiled back in December?
I did.
This is what preppers get wrong, though. Like, you're not going to need all those like fancy survival gears. You're going to need some extra Cheetos.
Well, let me, sorry, there's a couple of things here first. The I recently scored a bulk pack of not toilet paper, but paper towels. And it felt like what I imagine, you know, the Soviet spies when they defected and entered an American grocery store for the first time. You know, oh my God. That sort of felt like that personally. But yeah, you know, I mean, there's a whole lot to say about sort of the preppers. I'm not the survivalist. Just think about like all those preppers and survivalists and, you know, the Obama
administration.
They were
waiting for this time. Yeah.
They were. And then now they're out protesting. Oh, I can't go to Baskin Robbins.
Yep. Get my hair cut. I got to say, one of the first times I ventured out with the whole gear, the mask, the gloves, I went to like three different stores looking for the stuff we needed. When I came home, I felt like I had gone hunting and like killed killed an animal and like skinned it and brought it back to my family. It was just toilet paper, but it felt comparable, I think. Anyway, I do want to talk about the new book. I started reading it. It's called Burn In, a novel, The Real Robotic Revolution. So tell us about it, Peter. It's kind of amazing.
That's really kind of you. So it's a new kind of book. It blends fiction and nonfiction. So it's a techno thriller that follows an FBI agent as she hunts for a terrorist through Washington, D.C. of the future. And just as an aside, you know, by saying she, you can see how it's a different kind of central character than you usually have in techno thrillers. But so it's fiction. But at the same time, it's nonfiction. Baked into the story are some 300 explanations and predictions with the footnotes for them. So it's basically taking nonfiction research on the kind of things that we all need to know. Now, everything from, okay, how does AI that's going to shape our world work, to what are some of the issues of bias that are going to play out, security, to what are the toys that your kid's going to be using. And rather than me just dreaming it up, it's here's the research for it. So the idea is, as obvious, I'm a parent. I think of it as like sneaking the veggies into the smoothie. You get an interesting, exciting read, but also walk away from it a little bit more informed.
As I've been reading, I am completely not a techie. I can still barely just figure out how to like get onto Netflix. But as I keep reading, I keep thinking, wait, is that real? Is that possible? Is that a thing? Is he just making this? But yeah, they got footnotes. It explains the technology that you're using and some of the predictions. I mean, when did you start writing this, by the way?
So the project started about 4 years ago, and you know, we did the research, you know, of everything from interviewing experts to building these big databases, and some of the things that we uncovered were pretty scary. For example, one was an interview with someone who works on the water systems in Washington, D.C., and he revealed essentially how to hack them.
Oh my God!
Yeah, and for anyone wanting to get a sense of what that might look like, Google 1936 flood, and you see the kind of impact that it could have. So you have that kind of research. We started that 4 years ago, but you're also doing world building. You're building out these characters, right. You're building out these scenes. And, you know, from that, we're drawing from the science fiction that we love. But, you know, one to what Susan was saying, the subtitle of the book is it's a novel of the real robotic revolution. And the idea is that it's not another one of those, you know, human must be destroyed by robot, you know, the Terminator, Matrix style stuff. Instead, it's the way robots are really going to be and the way that we will interact with them and frankly, how we already interact with them. So one of the other characters is a machine. It's basically your Alexa or Siri move forward 10 years. But the result is that both the characters in the story, but also you, the reader, can't help but thinking about the machine as a character, which we already do. You know, so for example, right. In my home, when you know, Alexa doesn't give the answer that I want, I get mad at it. Or my kids, when they want to know whether I really told them the truth on some kind of trivia thing, they'll go ask Alexa. And so we play with that a little bit. And again, it's one of these real things that's happening.
Wow. Well, the book comes out May 26th. Listeners can pre-order now. So definitely pre-order. And Susan, I'm buying you a copy. So
awesome.
All right. But I also want to talk a little bit about a recent article you wrote for Defense One. I mean, not so recent, but early February. And you pointed us to this, given what we're going to talk about pretty much for the rest of the episode. And the title of that article was How China is Working to Quarantine the Truth About Coronavirus. And now, as we look at the landscape, you kind of analyze the different phases of this disinformation campaign by China. But I feel like, you know, we're seeing that in so many different iterations, whether it's this administration, whether it's the media, whether it's, you know, social media. But can you walk us a little bit through your analysis in that article?
Sure. So the background to it is that I had done a previous nonfiction book called Like War. And Like War is about the weaponization of social media. If you think of cyber war is the hacking of networks. Like War is the hacking of people on social networks by driving ideas viral. And just like you said, you know, we see it played by, you know, everything from Russian information warfare to, you know, far right echo chamber to China to Iran to even Taylor Swift plays it like war, does it as a way of driving record sales. It's how you drive things viral online. And so that article was a follow-up to it where we were tracking what was going on in Chinese social media. It may be a nation where there's a large amount of censorship, but there's also a large amount of discussion online. And the most important thing of that article is that the research was done in January. And what we found was that there was a government campaign essentially to censor and shape what was being talked about relevant to coronavirus and that the outbreak, therefore, was much greater than what the government was letting on. We did also a second article that came out the next day that looked at what the Chinese military was doing. Again, everything available online, nothing super secret, government document, et cetera, just what you could observe and document. And it found that the Chinese military was also not responding to the level that was needed for a pandemic. Now, again, go back to that date, early February, and we were not the only ones saying this. This utterly debunks any of this nonsense that you hear right now that's either, how could we have known? We knew, we were talking about it. Or you have the second narrative that's, well, China lied to us. Yes, they lied to us. And yes, we all knew they lied to us. And I say we all knew it. It wasn't just experts. It was every other nation out there was looking at the same data. And unlike the U.S., they were preparing. And that's why you see the Taiwans, the South Koreas, the Australias all weathering this storm far more effectively. I mean, to put numbers on it, you know, as you and I are talking, the U.S. has passed the 40,000 deaths from coronavirus. Australia is at 74. Think about that.
74 deaths total.
Yes. Or if we have South Korea, South Korea, starting point, exact same date of the first known case in South Korea as the first known case in the United States, 238 deaths.
I mean, I don't know exactly the population. I mean, I'm sure there's a big disparity, but certainly. But you believe that we can trust those numbers coming out of South Korea? Because we know the numbers coming out of China. I think 4,600 deaths, there's no way.
Yeah, so South Korea's population is 52 million. So yes, smaller than the U.S., but if you want to multiply each by six, you know, so you rough, we're talking about number, roughly around 1,200 deaths equivalent U.S. population versus 40,000 and growing. They've also tailed off. Same, you know, Australia, obviously also smaller than the U.S. The point of this is to circle back is that it was known in early February, not just all the things that we have since come out about internal warnings within the Trump administration, but also it was openly known and talked about and published and discussed months back, and even the narrative of, well, China lied to us. Yes, of course they lied. We knew they were lying in 2020. We knew they lied in 2019. We knew they lied in 1999. They're an authoritarian government. This is what they do. Only a fool would praise them and talk about them doing a good job. Oh, like Donald Trump did during this period when it was openly known that they were lying. So this narrative, this gaslighting that's going on of saying, how could we have known? Come on.
Well, the irony of that, and Susan and I have discussed this a number of times, the irony of that is he couples that along with saying, well, I acted early. I did know. And
yeah, I did always know. I always knew what was going on.
You know, Susan, we are all basically sheltering at home, quarantining and trying to stay safe and healthy. But also one thing I've been doing, one thing I've been doing is I have been just kind of like streamlining everything. I mean, I like my garage, my pantry, and even, by the way, my finances.
Wow, you are doing way better at quarantining than I am.
Well, I spent a couple of weeks doing absolutely nothing, and now I'm like, I gotta do something. But let me give you an example. One of the things I have managed to do is consolidate my credit cards, because believe me, getting multiple statements, managing multiple accounts, big pain in the butt. I don't have to do that anymore.
How'd you do that?
Lightstream. We've talked about Lightstream before.
Lightstream is with SunTrust, and I've been with them forever. They're a great bank.
SunTrust is a great bank, and Lightstream is a great service because Lightstream has credit card consolidation loans with rates that start at just 5.95 APR. They've got auto pay, and there are absolutely no fees, zero fees.
And with Lightstream, you can quickly roll balances from multiple credit cards into one single monthly loan payment. Get a low, fixed interest rate and free up more money in your monthly budget.
You can even get your Lightstream credit card consolidation loan the day you apply.
Apply today to get a special interest rate discount and save even more. The only way to get this discount is to go to lightstream.com/45th. That's LIGHTSTREAM.com/45th.
Subject to credit approval, rate includes a 0.5 auto pay discount. Terms and conditions apply and offers are subject to change without notice. Visit lightstream.com/45th for more information. The interesting thing is, in that particular article, you kind of lay out like the different phases of the disinformation campaign in China. And I feel like the Trump administration is in like every phase at the same time. It's not kind of planned like the disinformation. It's just organic with this administration.
The first thing is to break down what China was doing. And this was, at that point in time, targeting their own population. And their campaign basically broke into three parts, and you're going to, these will definitely sound familiar to you. So the first part of it is that they were downplaying it. They were saying the outbreak is not as bad as people are saying, et cetera, et cetera. And they were even, for example, going after individual medical experts who were reporting it, doctors in that region, and saying that they're unduly scaring the population. The second track of it is once it started to break out and you couldn't deny that it was happening, there was a lot of critique of the government's response. And so they started out pushing false information about how good the government's response was. For example, they were claiming that new hospitals were being built and they were posting images of them, and then it would turn out that the photo was actually of an apartment building that had been built months earlier. And then the third thing that they did is they went to blame shifting, blaming other people, other nations for the problem. So just like you were hitting on, each one of those three is exactly later on the same sort of approach that the Trump administration did. Downplaying, and then when you couldn't do that anymore, claiming that you were doing a better job than you were. Remember all the stuff about all the testing that we were getting? And so, you know, what you see again is that these strategies are used by various actors again and again and again. The one thing, though, where I differ with you is, you know, you said it's kind of organic. No, it's planned out. It's a strategy. There's nothing sort of natural about this. And, you know, you can see this. What relevant to, you know, we've had these pop-up protests against the state rules on stay at home.
Operation Gridlock, right? Is what they're calling it across the states, Operation Gridlock?
Earlier it opened up, et cetera, but not only can you data trail push behind it, but they had preset hashtags ready to go, et cetera. And it's all about you think about it, it's sort of called astroturfing. It's not an organic grassroots movement. It's creating the simulation of one, and then it has a real effect. So you get a small number of these. You then have, if you look at the actual numbers of people that showed up, it's pathetic. In the first wave of them, it's like 30. This is nothing you would talk about of national scale, except it was able to drive the conversation on national scale. It gets covered not just on social media, it gets covered on TV, newspaper, you name it. And then you start to see real world copycatting of it. It's a perfect parallel to what we saw of the inorganic protests that were sparked by Russian information during 2016, where you actually in one case, Russia was able to sort of create a pop-up protest of people on both sides in Florida.
And it kind of reminds me, though, of the protest they had, like the Trump's inauguration, when you had some protesters, for sure, they were out there and there was some civil disobedience and some mayhem, but it was pretty minor mayhem. But you'd have like one or two like small trash can fires, and then like 100 photographers crowded around to get images of this one like sad little burning trash can. And it's a news void that's being filled, and they're happy to have the content. But in terms of whether it's organic or real, I do think at the early stages, it's not part of this grand plan or grand disinformation like design. It's sort of like at those stages, the governments themselves don't know what they're dealing with. China itself didn't know exactly what it was handling. It had some clues. There were some parts of it which would have had more knowledge than the rest of the world at the time, but they didn't know this was going to happen. It's more their first response was to just shut down any criticism and any sort of, you know, possible critique of their approach, whatever the source, whatever the origins, without regard for whether it was true or not. They probably didn't believe it themselves, at least not at first, and they were in the whole denial stage or the self-preservation denial stage. when they first started to stamp down on the you know, the chats online and the comments from doctors.
Well, I mean, they actually had the doctors like repudiate their own statements, yeah. Right? There, I mean, that was a part of what you reported.
But that's
Peter.
Local police. At that stage, I don't have a real grasp of what's actually going on or if this is real or not. They don't really care.
How big it's going to be. Well, let me ask you this, Peter. I mean, as an authoritarian government, do you think China maybe has been able to better control the outbreak than the United States? Maybe that's one of the reasons that we're not able to see the same kind of numbers here.
To Susan's point, it's exactly what you saw is the government put its own interests and self-preservation of regime above public health. So when bad news was breaking out that it worried might reflect poorly on both it and how its economy was doing, instead of reacting to say, what can we do about this outbreak, it actually went after the people warning about it. It's a very natural instinct among authoritarian regimes. And unfortunately, we saw a similar kind of play here of downplaying of risk. You know, remember, as late as February 28th, Trump is saying that we will be, quote, close to zero, end quote, cases in a couple of days. And that's why we don't need to do much about it. So it's putting regime above public health interest. And the irony, of course, is that it, by playing that game, it not only puts more people at risk, it actually also ultimately creates a greater challenge for that regime. And then you get this question of, how can you effectively respond to it? And some people think that authoritarian regimes are better equipped to deal with this. China, early stage, very clearly poorly responded, tried to make it look like everything was okay. Early stage, not only was, as Susan noted, you know, going after doctors who were speaking out, it was allowing public gatherings. There was in particular one that should have not been allowed to happen, and that accelerates it. And then it pivots to the other side and has a lockdown of a level that would be really hard to implement here. By contrast, you have other authoritarian regimes. So China, kind of a mixed record. Other authoritarian regimes have done really poorly at this. Russia is in the midst of a pretty large outbreak right now. Turkey, a kind of quasi-authoritarian democracy, has a pretty large outbreak. And one of the things that these regimes do is they also downplay the death toll. There's a recent report that found that the Turkey death toll seems to be off by about 2,000. So there's nothing inherent about an authoritarian regime that means they do better on it. And I like going back to those examples of the countries like a South Korea, like an Australia, or Iceland, or Austria, or Germany. These are all democracies that have handled it pretty well. And actually, most of them are now moving to the period of reopening up their economy. By contrast, you have
then
other
you have
democracies.
Sweden.
Yeah, Sweden is an almost perfect example. Just within the Baltics, so you actually have a smaller set of very similar countries, and essentially Sweden went its own way compared to what Norway and Finland did. And you can see this sort of you track the data, and the other nations tail off and go down in their daily coronavirus cases and deaths. And Sweden, that kind of more followed the US model of kind of denial and leaving things open, it just keeps going up and up. And so it's one of these things where, from like a research standpoint, the evidence is just staring you at your face. You're running all of these live nation-sized experiments, and you can see exactly how policy matters so much. Mm-hmm. The problem for the U.S. is that we had this warning and we didn't listen to it. And what I worry about is that we're now going to see this happen on a state level where, you know, you see certain states reopening back up contrary to what public health is telling them to do. And about 2 to 3 weeks from now, you're going to see those numbers.
Go Georgia, home state.
All right. Your home state. Susan, have you watched every single thing online? Are you done with Netflix, the whole queue?
I am pretty sure I've watched the entire internet at this point.
What's the entire internet? Here's the thing. There's more internet out there, more content out there that I bet you don't even have access to.
There is streaming stuff beyond the U.S.'s borders, and you can now get it to you even though we're in the U.S. in quarantine by using ExpressVPN.
Yep. So with ExpressVPN, you can like binge UK Netflix. I mean, there's so many other more Netflixes out there. So much more content. And all you do is use their app.
And we all know that ExpressVPN also protects your privacy and security online, but it also does help you get into all the extra Hulus and internets that you need.
I love dark, moody, like Norwegian murder mysteries. And so, yeah, I need to be able to access that stuff. And I can't do it with American Netflix.
See, ExpressVPN hides your IP address and lets you control where you want sites to think you're located. You can choose from almost 100 different countries. So just think about all the Netflix libraries you can go through.
And it's not just Netflix. Hulu, BBC, iPlayer, YouTube. I mean, there's so many other. I know there's a lot of VPNs out there, but the reason that we use ExpressVPN, because it's actually really, really fast. There's never any buffering, no lag. You can stream in HD without any problem.
If you visit our special link right now at expressvpn.com/45th, you can get an extra 3 months of ExpressVPN for free. Support the show, watch what you want, and protect yourself with ExpressVPN at expressvpn.com/45th.
You've got the president tweeting things, you know, less than a week ago, tweeting, liberate Michigan, liberate Minnesota, liberate Virginia. I mean, you know, he's encouraging the protests. The protests are directly tied to reopening. And, you know, I wanted to talk a little bit about it was reported in the Washington Post yesterday that apparently it's an unknown activist is how they framed it. Seems like criminal to me, have apparently posted 25,000 email addresses and passwords belonging to NIH, WHO, the Gates Foundation, and others, other groups that are working to combat the coronavirus pandemic. I don't know if you've seen this story, but apparently though, so now these emails and passwords were posted to 4chan. And then apparently after that, neo-Nazi and white supremacists capitalize on the list. They're publishing them. They're using the data to call for a harassment campaign against people working in these groups and also fomenting more conspiracy theories, which all seems to, again, tie in with, Peter, what you were talking about in terms of this very planned response we're seeing in terms of the protests and stuff.
Yeah, it's one of the interesting data points when you crunch the numbers is that of all the coronavirus conspiracy theories out there, and they literally number in the hundreds. One data point I saw was that 110 different, not just conspiracy theories, but campaigns behind them to drive their theory viral. Over 110 have been discovered. The one that has resonated the most is, weirdly enough, that Bill Gates was somehow behind all of this. And again, going back to, you know, is this organic or not, that conspiracy theory only takes off after he contradicts the president on best health practices, what's needed to protect the American population. It's only then that conspiracy theory then spikes.
Okay, but you are overlooking the best conspiracy theory.
Oh, which one is that?
The mole children.
There's a mole children theory? I have
no idea. Oh, yes, the mole children. Rabia, do you know what all those hospitals really are for?
Oh, God.
In New York?
No, I mean,
they're
I guess
to re-nurture, like re-feed the starving mole children that are being liberated from the tunnels under New York. But hold on. There's actually like a schism in the community because like half of this conspiracy theory group thinks it's really inappropriate and sensitive to call them mole children.
Oh, they're politically correct. That's kind of sweet, actually.
Yes. So they're like, you can't call them mole children. They're being free. We need to give better names to them. That's like a whole QAnon side conspiracy.
Are the mole children part of the deep state?
They are victims of the deep state. They are mole children who have been like kidnapped and raised in the dark for nefarious purposes that are now being liberated by Trump. And when Trump
part of
said
the Clinton's sex pedophilia ring,
it's
thing?
All yeah, all related to that. Okay. And when Trump said there's light in the tunnel, he was tipping them off that the mole children are coming to the surface.
Oh wow!
So okay. That one has not gotten the same kind of legs as the Bill Gates one has. But
all right, I did want to mention we usually do this at the top of the show, but what the numbers are looking like right now, what we know, and then kind of determining. Can we believe those numbers? So United States right now, according to at least Johns Hopkins, about, I think, a little over 825,000 reported cases. And then we have topped 45,000 deaths in the U.S. However, ProPublica reported just yesterday that there is a huge spike in the number of reported home deaths. Nearly six-fold increase at 200 home deaths a day in New York, which, you know, can, I mean, that's not, I mean, this is way above, you know, the six times what the officials expect normally to happen. So either these are people who are dying from the virus or that they had other other issues that couldn't be addressed because the hospitals and healthcare workers are overwhelmed with responding to the virus itself. But so it seems like the numbers of the deaths are also probably on the, not including many of the home deaths and other things that are not being counted in it. One of the things I wanted to talk to you about, though, is, Peter, you, a story that actually we've been, we have tracked for a couple of weeks now, and that is the story related to the Navy, which, you know, over the last, what, month or so, it's just been one thing after another. I think, Susan, what was the latest we reported last week? Did we talk about it last week?
Well, the Navy Secretary is out after his,
right,
you know, 15-minute Trumpian rant on board the TR. And unfortunately, the as expected, as was obvious, the infections on the ship have spread almost like a fourth of the whole ship now, I believe, is confirmed infected. And there's been at least one death and several more ICU hospitalizations.
Do we know what is actually happening with the people on the ship? Are they still like isolated?
They're trying to do what they can. They have a skeleton crew there, like just the bare number needed to keep the nuclear reactors running and keep the ship functioning. But it's a skeleton crew. Most of them are on shore in Guam now.
Yeah, so the ship, the latest data is that there are 710 coronavirus cases among the crew. Multiple are in the hospital. One, unfortunately, died. Now, that number is obviously a pretty large percentage of the crew. I don't have it in front of me, but I think it's the crew sizes, if you include the air, probably around like 4,000. So pretty high percentage. What was particularly worrying, what got missed in a lot of this and what particularly worried the captain was not just how it was just spreading like wildfire across the crew. And this is with the action that he took. The ship was brought in Guam. And just as you said, the crew is on shore in sort of the equivalent of dormitory. So they're not in the closed spaces. If the 710 figure would be much past it, certainly in the thousands if he'd not taken that action. But the particular thing that worried him and that's been missed in this is that in an aircraft carrier, it's not like you can swap people into certain roles. So, for example, people who are working, this is as a nuclear powered carrier. So there was reports that a couple of them were among the nuclear, the engineers working literally the ship's nuclear power plant. You can't say, oh, well, one person is sick, we have to swap someone else into it. Or a different example is the air crew. You can't say, well, the pilot got sick, I'll have the cook go over and do that job now. So he was saying, you know, look, this is not just spreading and endangering people, it's making us ineffective. One of the other things that's happened since then is, you know, after that absurd meltdown that the acting Secretary of the Navy, again, not Senate confirmed, had. And in his meltdown, you know, he blamed the captain. He spread a lie about him. He said that the captain had sent his warning to 20 to 30 people. It's now been shown that actually he only sent it to, I believe the number was 8 in his chain of command. So the acting SecNav turns out to have been lying about that. But he also, in taking that flight out there against Navy policy to go do his rant, it not only cost the taxpayers $243,000, but also that guy is now in quarantine as well as the flight crew.
Because he exposed himself, yeah. But you see, you call it a meltdown, but what's really disturbing is that it almost seemed like that was intentional and planned. Like, that was his sober-minded decision, was to get on the ship, give a 15-minute, you know, Trumpian rant, and get off again. Like, that was his strategy.
Yeah, when I say meltdown, I don't defend it. I think rant was another good way of putting it. And let's be clear, it not only included now proven to be lies about that captain, he also had this whole kind of conspiracy theory about now the media is out to get us and this is all a media thing. And if you listen to the recordings of it, the crew then leaks it, and you can hear one of the sailors say, literally, "What the fuck?"
and a little more passion to it, though.
Yeah, and because they're the ones living this, and they're the ones seeing their shipments. And oh, by the way, they're the ones who cheered the captain. But that case is going to be taught in military academy and naval war college for generations to come. And I guarantee you that the hero of the story, when they teach future naval officers, is not going to be the Trumpian acting Secretary of Navy who turned out to have lied, had his rant, and has cost the taxpayers money by violating policy and is now sitting in quarantine.
What's striking to me, Susan, is like, you said he made a sober-minded decision, but that decision was based, had to be based on his actually sincerely held belief that this is actually not such a danger. This is not that contagious. This is just, maybe it's like a flu.
I don't think it's that. I think it was
for him to have exposed himself like that.
He did. He was on the ship 15 minutes and he didn't talk to anyone. He was actually minimally exposed. He was exposed, has to be in isolation, but he didn't like meet people on the ship. He didn't like glad hand. He didn't risk overly getting infected himself.
Yeah, then that's part of what people have pointed out is that, he's saying everything is okay. And actually, he did the speech, over a mic and didn't go interact with the crew.
Yeah.
So he flew all the way to Guam and didn't interact with the crew and then got in the plane, went back. But because you'd had an outbreak area, both he and the flight crew, his own plane, the personal jet, they then have to be quarantined.
Speaking of the Navy, we have a couple more news stories we want to get through in the next 15 minutes or so. Trump, was it this morning that he tweeted an order out at the Navy?
Are we going to call it an order? Because, it's phrased as one, but it's not. It's just a tweet. Until someone decides to take it seriously, it's still just a tweet.
Is that right? That's not an order? Peter, you saw what we're talking about, right?
Yeah. But there's another part of it that's just hilarious. And they would, of course, savage anyone else who said it. He says, I have instructed the United States Navy to shoot down destroy any and all Iranian gunboats if they harass our ships at sea. And so
maybe they're flying too close,
obviously.
To the
they're floating in the air. They're like hovercraft now. It's just absurd. It's so ignorant. And yet, again, you would see all the usual talking heads. If anyone else had said this, they would mock it. They would laugh at, this shows how he doesn't get the military. And instead, this is Trump being tough. It's not only, absurd, but it's also, again, this sort of distraction. It's equivalent to the, at the start of a coronavirus briefing saying, and I've instructed our Coast Guard to do something about these horrible drug smugglers that are coming. It's like, wave your hands over here. Don't look at this. Yeah.
Speaking of distraction, I wanted to talk a little bit about the new immigration ban that apparently he's going to sign into executive order today. And I know that's been causing some concern in the last couple of days, but it's complete posturing. It's utter posturing because he backtracked a little bit. He was like, immigration ban, meaning like nobody's going to come in. No immigrants are going to come in. Now, the word immigrant itself is a legal definition. It's somebody who's coming to stay as a permanent resident. But then yesterday it was reported that apparently U.S. citizens that are seeking to bring their spouses or children are exempt from that. Anybody with a temporary work visa is exempt for that. Visitor visas are exempt for that. He's saying something to his base, basically, because he keeps wanting to tap into that. But this is actually going to have an impact on very, very few people. It's really going to have an impact on just a couple of categories of immigrants who, if you know anything about how the process works, like, for example, it might be an employer who is bringing somebody over here on an immigrant visa. Those things take years anyway. Somebody who's been waiting since 2009 is maybe going to have to wait two more months if they were due to get their visa in this time. They said they're going to ban issuing green cards. However, there's two ways to get green cards. Number one is you enter the country on an immigrant visa. You enter the country because, let's say, you've waited your 10 years or 5 years or however long it took to get it, and then they'll mail it to you in a couple of months. The second way to get it is you're already in the country and somebody sponsored you and you're about to get it. Well, here's the thing. You know, he says that the reason he's doing this is to save the economy, is to save American jobs. However, anybody who's in the country waiting for a green card, until they get that green card, they can still work because they have something called employment authorization. You have an employment authorization card that allows you to work until you get your actual green card. So in no way, shape, or form does this do almost anything to protect American jobs. I just really...
Well, he tweeted something, so they had to do something, and this is the best they could do.
Well, I mean, I just, as an immigration lawyer, I was like, I gotta really, like, dig into this and figure out what's happening. Kind of nothing's happening, so... Those people who care don't really have to worry too much about it.
They had to make it seem like his tweet meant something, and this was the best they could come up with. Like, that was, there was no plan. It was just a tweet.
Well, I mean, then he ties it back to the wall and stuff. I mean, this is, these are just his standard talking points, right? Like, to garner support. And speaking of which, where are the polls right now? Anybody know?
You mean the fake news polls? I don't know.
Okay, we don't know.
One thing in the polls that has jumped out is that typically in when you have some kind of national emergency, a national crisis, a 9/11 type moment, yeah, or something like that. Historically, there's always this, you know, kind of, you know, they call it the rally around the flag moment, and the president polls spike. And, you know, it doesn't mean that person wins election. I mean, George Bush Sr. had astronomical polling numbers coming during the Persian Gulf War, and he still loses. But what has been notable about it is that Trump got the smallest historic bump in the history of these presidential polling in terms of crises, and that it's already dissipated. And in a lot of ways, it's because he can't get out of his own way, right? If he seems to draw this, you know, personal energy from these briefings, and yet, you know, yeah, they're good for his base, but they're backfiring on everyone else.
And I don't think they're so good for his base. Like, they aren't. Some of his base likes him and cheers him on, but I think they're actually off-putting to even to the hardcore ones who aren't going to ever leave him over this. They still can tell all he's talking about is himself. Like, it's always me, 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 how great I am all the time. And they see that. It's kind of uncomfortable. Like, again, it's not going to cause him to not support Trump. But I don't think he's shoring the base up through doing this. It's purely just his ego that's benefiting.
I also want to talk a little bit about, I feel like, you know, what happens at these briefings is, I mean, it's kind of falls into a familiar pattern. Oh, did you guys watch the briefing like 2 days ago where he, was it over the weekend, where he made them play a clip of Cuomo praising the federal government's response? The clip didn't play properly, so he made them play it again, like, towards the end of the briefing. It was just,
like,
so
I tried to, but it's so, they've gotten, they're just so boring. Like, okay, I'll turn in for a bit, but there's nothing that's,
it's pretty predictable.
Rolled them out all in one long continuous stream, you couldn't tell really when things started and ended, and nothing would be different. It's just Groundhog Day every single day.
I think one of the most dangerous parts of these briefings are, though, however, questions around the reopening stuff. And just yesterday, Dr. Birx, I'm really losing faith in Dr. Birx, to be honest.
Have any to lose? She's awful.
I kind of thought, well, look, she's got to play this right so she can get the information to the public. But yesterday she was asked, you know, what do you think about, like, reopening orders from, for example,
Nobody
Georgia,
your home state, bad,
where they're like, oh, we're going to reopen hair salons and this, that, and the other.
Massage parlors, essential business now, apparently.
That's Georgia's, like,
tattoo parlors. Like, what? I can,
well, you
get
can't.
Some
you cannot
these,
tattoo at a distance. I mean, you cannot massage at a distance. But her response was, well, as long as they follow the
apparently,
protocols.
Apparently, like, Georgia's economy
distance,
is running on tattoo parlors
and, you know,
massage
and just
parlors.
Listen to your governors, you should be okay.
I thought it was, like, peanuts and peaches, but.
Yeah. Okay.
So I did hear that response, and I had a slightly different take on it. The overall effect was absolutely, like, no criticism, no contradiction, no, I mean, it didn't seem like she was saying anything interesting at all. Listening to her exact words, though, I think that was her awful, horrible, like, coward's way of saying this should not happen. Because she kept saying, here's what the guidelines say, and if a state has this, then this is what they should be doing. But none of that applied to Georgia. So her actual words were saying Georgia shouldn't do this, but she did everything in her power to say that without saying those words.
That's a generous and interesting perspective, and people like me wouldn't get it.
It's a bit of a parallel to what Trump is trying to pull off in the overall strategy, is that you have these guidelines, and guidelines is, you know, sounds, it simultaneously sounds like it is required, and it's also a suggestion. And so there are federal guidelines for what you are supposed to be doing. And yet simultaneous to that, he's urging on people, you know, as was mentioned at these protests, and he talked about the tweets that he's doing, to violate these guidelines, whether it's as individuals, but also at the state level. And he's trying to sort of have it that when it goes bad, as it surely will, he'll say, well, that's the fault of that state, not what we tried to do on the federal level. And then when you see the reductions because of certain states following the guidelines, it's look at the great job that we did. But yeah, I don't have a lot of empathy for, you know, when she's saying, well, if you just follow the guidelines, but then we're talking about things where it's literally impossible to follow those guidelines. A state like Georgia has definitely not met the things that need to be in place before you are supposed to reopen, whether it's the disease numbers to testing or whatever, to more specific examples. I mean, I go back to that, you know, it's a joke, but it's seriously about a tattoo parlor. How do you follow social distancing guidelines at a tattoo parlor? Is it like a 7 foot long needle that you're using? And you know, and also the idea that this is among the things that we need to turn back on in our society. Come on.
You know, it's. I saw on Twitter somebody suggested it's really interesting that the businesses that are being allowed to reopen are kind of like classic mom and pop's operations for money laundering and not like some of the bigger stuff. But anyway, it was.
I don't think that's it. I think that's just. I mean, it's a weird focus for him to do. But again, they are smaller businesses. Yeah. They're probably reliable Republican voters in terms of like a small business owner who's now had their whole livelihood taken away.
Yeah.
I mean, well, to be real, let's be fair, it's not coming back. Even if they allow them to go into open businesses, people aren't going to go in the numbers that they need to be sustainable.
Right. And then, and now we're already looking at not just the possibility, but the absolute likelihood and probability of a severe second wave that they are saying that we should expect sometime in the fall. And so you guys want to talk a little bit about that or?
We don't know for sure that's going to happen, but all pandemics in the past have had this pattern. Like about 6 months after the first wave, regardless of season, you get another. And
it was raised in the briefing yesterday.
Well, we had an interview on CNN, or CNN had a report on an interview with CDC Director Redfield,
right,
who has been weirdly MIA for like months now. Like CDC should have been like leading the charge on this stuff, and he's almost never heard from.
Is he part of the task force?
He has to be, but he's not active on it. But he gave, first time in a while, gave an interview, and he made statements to CNN about how. And we've also heard Fauci talk about this before, too. It's not the first time this has come from the White House. But he was talking about how there's a possibility that the assault of the virus on our nation next winter will actually be even more difficult than the one we just went through. We're going to have a flu epidemic and a coronavirus epidemic at the same time. And, you know, this is not that controversial. Like, that's
right.
Logically what we can expect to probably happen. But guess who doesn't like that message?
Right. Trump tweeted about this morning.
There is an issue that goes back to what you noted. He's been weirdly absent, is that if you'll recall, he was actually out there up to mid-March giving public statements about it. And then I believe the date was like March 16th or March 17th. He suddenly pulled back from any and all press interviews and the like, and it's basically because the CDC director was not in line with the narrative that the administration was pushing back then, which was that this is all under control, it's all going well. He's basically the one who's warning that it's going to grow greater, and you can go back and find the news articles about these abrupt cancellations of interviews that have been with him, and it's part of this period where, you know, they're trying to push one narrative. And unfortunately, certain medical experts are not aligning with it. The big key to me in terms of the question of the second wave, and not, you know, me, but what we're seeing in terms of public health experts talk about, is the crucial thing whether it's how to reopen the economy safely to how we will handle a potential next wave of it. Testing, 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 testing.
Right.
The reports show that we need at least three times the level of testing that we have right now. And it is just so scary and frustrating that we are months into this and that we still have nowhere near the sufficient level. Again, that other nations have been able to put into place, other nations of different sizes, different locales, different level of wealth. And this falls back onto just the incredibly poor job that the administration has done, which has been driven by initially downplaying it and then being just utterly disorganized. I mean, the fact that you've got son-in-law running, trying to spread testing is, basically it's gone as well as his Middle East peace plan.
And meanwhile, you have Trump at these briefings who's talking about how people disagree on testing. Not everyone's such a big believer in testing, and that, I mean, clearly he means himself. He's the only one out there saying this, but he's like trying to imply that there's a debate that, oh, maybe you don't want that much testing.
Well, do you remember 6 weeks back? It was, oh, no, there's all the testing you need. It's available. And it's actually going to be out in the parking lot of Walmart and the like. And I don't know your area, but, it's certainly not to that level here. And it's not anywhere. If the only way out of this is to get to a sufficient testing level.
And that's going to depend on the governor's response. I mean, 100%. Governor Hogan, Larry Hogan of Maryland, this past week was able to secure half a million tests from South Korea. His wife is apparently has a comp because she's from South Korea, had the connections to secure those tests. And he tweeted some shade at Trump saying that, oh yeah, thanks for letting us use, federal labs. Now that we have the test to actually submit to those labs, we can do something with them. All right. One last story I wanted to touch on for maybe 60 seconds before we wrap up, and that is reports coming out of North Korea, or maybe not. Peter, what do you think about the veracity of this information? Is Kim really, really sick? Is he dead? What's going on?
I mean, he's really sick. Let's put it that way. That part is known. It is known.
the guy's morbidly obese, has a heart condition, et cetera. So he's not a healthy guy. I hate to break the news to people, but, he's not able to dunk a basketball or get holes in ones on 18 holes, all the other things that they claim about
him. No unicorn blood.
He can't get over to pick something up on the ground.
There's everything I've seen. There's sort of been a back and forth of sources on whether he had heart surgery or not, and some media saying no, some media saying yes. I've not seen any kind of hard data going one way or the other, but I guess you got to give a little bit of a tip of hat to North Korea, is that it somehow found a way to get attention paid to it in the midst of all of this. You didn't think that they could do it, but because they've been trying earlier, they'd actually had a couple missile tests and the like.
Right.
Everyone's like, not now, we're busy. Sorry, guys.
And they amped it up a level. If we have a succession crisis in a nuclear state in the midst of this, it's just going to take 2020 to the new level.
So what we do know is that he has been out of commission. He's been not appearing in public at events where it would have been unthinkable not to have him appear.
April 12th is the last time he appeared in public. And he's been gone for about
10
days.
So I think it's fair to think that, he's having some kind of medical issue. But the reports that were vague about him being
gravely
in
ill.
Grave danger, it was grave danger. What kind of medical assessment is that?
If he is missing incredibly important public events, which we know he is, it probably is kind of grave, I'm guessing. It would be pretty serious, I think, for him to, because he also would know what this means. I mean, how this threatens his authority. In terms of the succession question, I think Trump was asked about the succession question, and he's like, well, I just wish him well. Just sending him warm wishes in the briefing yesterday. So that's that. All right. So, Peter, can you tell our listeners where they can find you online, on social media, or wherever you'd like them to contact you?
My website's PW Singer. I'm on Twitter at Peter W. Singer. The new book that we talked about, Burn In, is at burninbook.com. And you can get it, you know, all the different great places to get books these days, whether it's the big, you know, platforms like, you know, Amazon and Barnes and Noble, to the other spaces like IndieBound and Bookshop. Bookshop's a really great outlet for people to know about if they're not familiar. It's allowing folks to buy books online, but it goes through local bookstores. All of those. Hope people... One, I hope they stay well. And two, if they're able to get the book, I hope they enjoy it and also find it useful. And I really appreciate you having me on too.
I'm sure they'll love it and be terrified by it, like me. We'd love to have you on again. And Susan, good to talk to you. And we'll be back in 7 days.
A big thanks to all our listeners for tuning in to the 45th podcast week after week. And if you'd like to give us further support, you can do that by becoming a patron at patreon.com/45thpod. By doing so, you can become a supporter and patron for as little as $5 a month. And to do so, again, go to patreon.com/45thpod. A shout out and thank you to our sponsors. They make this program possible. And I urge our listeners to please check out our sponsors and use their products. And thank you to them for helping us produce week after week. Thank you to our audio producer, Hannah McCarthy, our executive producer, Meethal Thelhan. And you can find us on social media. We are on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. Our handle is @45thpod. Our website is www.45thpod.com. Thanks again for tuning in. See you next week.
The dudes like will rock up in like a t-shirt and whatever, and that's fine. And I feel like as a woman, I mean, it's not like high standards these days, but I had to have like basic standards for the better chats.
Look, I did one yesterday. Now, granted, it was for the military, but everybody else was in suit and tie.
Oh,
and
God.
I was like, wow, you know, congrats to you for keeping to that.
I am always distracted by what's in the background. I was watching just even like the Disney sing-along thing with my daughter the other night. And I'm like, that guy is doing it with like dishes on his counter. Like I can't, I'm just so judgy.
Oh, there's a great Twitter site called Room Raider that's for you then. It's a guy who
really?
Comments on the background of, and he gives literally like
that's me.
One out of 10 of what the background in the room when they go on TV or whatnot is. It's great. It's glorious.
That will be my insomnia content for tonight. Thank you so much for that.